Accession number 31430, Mr. Leslie Higgins, Real 5. Now, while you were at Boris Amendment, I believe you were called out to help with the Canvey Island floods. So we haven't dealt with that. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Oh, that was, we'd finished training, and I'd gone back to the depot.
So you'd gone back from...
Yeah, we'd left Bury St Edmunds.
And you'd gone back to...
Back to Worley Barracks.
Right. And what were you... Well, before we start, what were you doing there? Just waiting or...
I was doing... I was assigned to a training company, an intake. And Sergeant Caddy took me into his squad, which I was pleased with, because I mentioned him earlier when we first got to the barracks. He took me into his squad, which was nice. But after we'd been there about a week, sleeping quite comfortably late one night. That was in the winter, early part of the year, 1953. The duty NCO of the guard came down and said, wake everybody up. There's some flooding in Canvey. So we got dressed, got everybody up, got into the army vehicles and were taken down to Canvey Island. And we were, our main job there was to pack sandbags, field sandbags into the dikes that were split.
Now how bad was the flooding? What was happening? Had it overflown in there?
It overflowed. There was some places 3 or 4 foot of water in the mainland of Canvey. And we were just on duty on the dikes, just filling up bags all the time. We were there for nearly 4 days and nights, soaking wet and miserable.
Were there many casualties amongst the civilians, or are they all gone?
Well, we weren't quite aware of that because they were kept away from us. But there were some deaths that we found over. But the night before this, which was strange, we were on a... There was the Royal Air Force and ourselves on the Guard of Honour at a British Legion new hall that had been opened. And I commented then, because you had to go down 8 steps into it. And comment I made was, what would happen if the sea came in? You know, quite casually, not realising that the sea could come in. But the hall itself was... probably under 5 foot of water when we got there. So that was a lot of waste of British Legion's hard-earned cash, you know.
And you just, stacked the
where the sea was breaking.
Were you able to block it, or was it...
We blocked it in one place and it burst through somewhere else. So it was a never-ending thing going on all the time.
And what were you filling the sandbags with? Was it sand, or was it...
It was sand or grit sand, you know. But I can relate to that and... go forward a few years to 1984. I say that because I became an instructor on the buses in 1984, having done 7 years as a driver. And when I went to Chiswick to be trained, I was put with a fellow there called George Sanders. Well, he realised he'd seen me before somewhere, a long, long time before. And it turned out that he was in the Middlesex Regiment, who were also based at Worley then. They'd just come back from Korea. And he was a sergeant in charge of a landing barge that was bringing sandbags to us, to my section, and I was in charge of that. And he recognised me all those years later as to being at Canvey Island, which I thought was remarkable, because we all change, you know. But going back to the island, 4 days, the sea subsided, obviously, and we just finished packing sandbags, and then, because that led to the barriers being put up higher and more strongly.
Now, tell me how you were doing back at Brentwood, you know, as a... We've talked a bit, you were in... Sergeant Caddy's, you were his... that second...
One of his lads, yeah.
So, what was it like watching the training from the other side? You'd just been through it.
Well, I'd done my own basic training, and I did continuation training. Then I did a training course, and I was now back doing training in the depot, training other people. My biggest problem with that was that probably 60% of the guys that were in training then were from my own school, and you know, people I'd swum against when I was swimming as a younger fella, so they knew me probably too much, because it's very difficult to all the people about who you're really been friends with too.
Did they take advantage of you? No, they were
quite good.
So it's more that you found it a bit difficult then?
Yeah, I found it a bit difficult, you know, giving people cookhouse duties, or you know, putting them on Jenkins for being scruffy or whatever the case may be, knowing that they knew me and I knew them, you know. But that was part of the job.
And how are you getting on with Sergeant Caddy?
Caddy was great. It was great. Last time I heard of him, he became a colonel, which was nice.
Now, so what, how long does this period, when did you get back to Worley Barracks? Would that be about March 52?
We got back there probably about February in 1953, and by June 1953 we were...
Hang on, I've got you in 52, so I may have slipped a bit. Sorry, that's my mistake, I just made the wrong note.
That was the early spring of 1953.
So you think about February, right?
Yeah, we carried on training there, teaching them as I did, doing exactly the same as I did, leaving one of the bolts off of the Bren gun, which we always did. But on an occasion of doing Sten gun training, we always used to say to the lads, if your gun jams, hold your right weapon in the left hand, raise your right hand and call out for help, which was the usual. But I was standing behind one of the lads, a boy named Clark, and he got a jam. And instead of putting his arm up and holding the weapon in the left hand, he just turned completely around, and 5 foot away from him I was standing with a Sten gun jam facing at my belly. So it was very difficult not to shout at him, because I thought, if I shout, he's going to jump and probably the gun will release itself and it will start working. So I just stepped aside out of line and walked up to him and whispered in his ear, turn round, face the range, which he did. And we found that there was a Sten gun bullet had got a misshape on it, and it had come up right across the chamber of the barrel and it was stuck. So we had to relieve him of the Sten gun and take it away and let the armoury sort that one out.
You'd had a very lucky escape.
That was a near one. That was near. And then after that we had some fun training down at Raynham in Essex.
And what were you doing there?
There were rifle range shooting, basically with rifles from 500 yards down to 100, running, standing, kneeling, sitting, that sort of thing. But we were there, apparently the IRA were quite busy then, and they were raiding military installations and were stealing weapons. And we were told to challenge anything that came near the ranges during the night, particularly cars. And we all knew our CO's car was a big Humber Snipe, great big green massive car to us then. And he decided to go out one night and come down to the range during the night that we were on standby. And one of our lads challenged him, and his driver didn't stop, so he stuck the rifle and the bayonet through a windscreen and nearly impaled the driver to the front seat. Well, he did stop, fortunately, and the CO got out and commended this bloke for his action, because the car could have been stolen by IRA and they could have been infiltrating quite openly into the ranges where the guns were. That was a little excitement that night, quite exciting. And then also on the next day we had the sandwiches that we were given on these occasions. You may have been already were told they were quite large, very, very indigestible and quite difficult to chew through. Well, we'd stopped for lunch, our squad had had all of its food, and our lieutenant, who was a from Poland, although he was in the British Army, he decided that our company was going to do a run down 500 yards and do a standing rifle shooting at 100 yards. So I commented that I thought the blokes had just eaten their heavy food and it would be a little bit unfair to them to expect me to run down 500 yards and start shooting at targets from 100. But his remark was that if it was in war, this is what would happen anyway. You know, you wouldn't have to be deciding whether you'd adjusted your sandwiches or not. But he gave my company orders to go up to the 500 yard bay, and I refused. And I refused three times, and two sergeants arrested me and stuck me in a 500 weight truck, and I was put under arrest for disobeying an order. The result of that was I was stripped of my Lance Corporal stripe.
Now, how did you feel about that? Because it's a bit unfair.
Choked, because I was getting on all right. I thought I was doing the right thing for me men, putting their interest at heart, you know. But that's how it was.
Was there any other punishment, or was that it?
I just got busted down. Relieved of my duties, as the word is.
So what did that mean? Because you were...
It meant going back into hanging about then and waiting to go into the battalion were coming home from Germany. They were, I don't think where they were based. Osnabrück, I think it was called. They came back home very shortly after.
So when was this you lost your rank? Do you know what month?
Probably middle of May, somewhere about May. And then suddenly we'd got 2 weeks embarkation leave. And I'd been put into D Company, 1st Battalion, the Essex Regiment, as was then.
Now where were they?
They'd come back from Germany and they were at Worley, yeah.
Now, what were your first impressions? So before we go into the embarkation preparation for going, what were your first impressions of the 1st Battalion? What do you think of them as a unit?
Marvellous, you know. They marched down from Brentwood Station into the barracks, you know, with first battle dress, you know, everything number one. They really looked good. Same did the Middlesex when they came back from Korea. You know, to me, they were... The cat's whiskers, they were soldiers. They looked it and they behaved as they should be, you know. And I thought, well, maybe one day I might get to that stage, you know. But it wasn't. They'd only been back 2 weeks and then we were getting ready to go away.
Now, what preparations were made? Is embarkation even the first part of it? Or?
Well, in actual fact, the embarkation was put back a little bit because of our Queen as now was brought to the throne because King George had died.
In June 53?
This was June 53, yeah. So we weren't allowed, she didn't allow, it was one of her decrees that no troops be sent abroad during the 2 weeks of the celebrations. So we were held back a little bit. And then we went on slightly after her Jubilee time.
So tell me about the... what about your embarkation leave? What do you do?
Well, the embarkation leave, believe it or not, I got married. 2 weeks to get married. That was my first marriage. They say, was it marry in haste, repent in your leisure. It was wonderful at the time, but it didn't work out eventually. So
you got married in June?
June, yeah. Just 18 year old.
And what made you decide? Well, obviously, that's real. But I mean, was there a reason for doing it then? Because you were going overseas? Or
probably
was it
because
just
we were going overseas, I suppose. And that was a bit of all family pressures, you know.
Was it a military funeral at all? Or I mean, did comrades make an arch or anything like
wedding.
That?
Wedding. There was wedding.
Did I say funeral?
Yeah, well, we could call it a funeral. No, we had about six or seven lads there that just stood down outside the church, you know, made it a little bit different, but very few family came to it.
Now, any other preparations for going overseas?
No,
any issue of uniform?
The only thing we got was that, and I said to, as was my first wife then, I said, if you see me coming, because she worked in a flower shop, I said, if you see me coming home by the weekend dressed in uniform, but with all my webbing dark green, no brasses, all black gunmetal stuff, and what they call them, spats, what we used to wear. If you see that, then you know we're going abroad, because that's what happened. We got issued with our blanco-free equipment, all black gunmetal.
But no different uniform, just...
No, the battle dress was the same. We were issued with some different coloured, like olive green denims and stuff, but the battle dress was basically the same.
Now, so when did you leave? June or July?
Just trying to think of that. It would be beginning, end of June. So almost the end of June, because it took us just over a month to get there.
Now, which ship did you go on?
I went out on steamship it was. Do they call them HMS? I'm not sure. HMT, that's Majesty's Troop Ship.
Yeah.
Majesty's Troop Ship. Windrush.
Empire Windrush.
Yeah.
Now, what were conditions like on on the mess deck where you...
Well, we were on C deck aft, and there was 120 of us on hammocks. We didn't have beds, had hammocks.
Now, how crowded was that? How did it feel down there?
Pretty grim, like cattle on a boat. You know, I mean, we're all set. It was just like a hangar of a ship, of an airplane hangar, and just beds hanging everywhere.
And how'd you take to hammocks?
I didn't mind a hammock, but we all swung one way and all swung the other. But when we went across into the Bay of Biscay, they were calling for people that knew that they wouldn't be seasick. And I'd done a lot of messing about in boats in my younger days, so I volunteered. And I got stern watch, right on the stern.
And you could see lookout duties?
Yeah, you could see the bow of the ship coming up above the funnel in some parts, and then it went down with a massive bang as it hit the sea. But 90% of the battalion were being seasick.
And how... I'll come back to the lookout. How bad was the seasickness?
Well, on the ship, 90% of them were. And just
were they being sick everywhere?
It was all over the troop decks, all over the toilet, in the canteens when food was being... It was really awful.
But it didn't make you sick?
No, I never squeamish like that, funny enough.
Now, tell me about your lookout duties.
Well, you had 2 hours off and 2 hours on, and your duty was to keep an eye on the bow, stern area, up to a certain point, up to where you could see quite safely without looking over the side of the ship. And you were there to see if anyone went over, because if you come out and was being sick over the guardrail, and you could go over the top without even noticing it. And that's what our duties were till we cleared the Biscay, and then the sea calmed down a little bit.
Now, what route did you take? What time is it?
They went via Suez, Port Suez, Port Said, up the Suez Canal, on towards Aden, where we had engine trouble.
Now, did you get ashore at all?
At Aden, they had to let us ashore because of the heat. They'd broken down. We were there 4 days. So they sent us ashore to see the sights, which was strange.
What did you think of Aden?
Awful. Gosh, a terrible place.
In what way?
Supposed to be the hottest place in the world. There's no grass there. You don't find any... No grass. No literal trees anywhere. Palm trees they've got. But nothing else much. Donkeys, camels.
How do you take to the heat? Some people don't like it.
No, I didn't mind it. I was all right. I didn't burn red, if you follow me. But we were told not to be too uncovered. But by that time, we were wearing shorts and hose tops and patties. Short sleeves shirts.
Did you visit ashore anywhere else, or was it just Aden?
We went to Aden, and once we left there and the engines were put right, we went on to Singapore, which I thought was a beautiful country.
In what way? What do you remember of it?
Statues of, for religious reasons, you know. Marvellous. Because being an artist, it was, you know, that was quite good. And we went swimming there at a club. I'm just trying to think of the name of the... It was a club. They had the name of a chap who was years and years ago in Victorian times.
Raffles.
Yeah, he did robbery. Robbed the rich to feed the poor, sort of thing. But it was called Raffles Club. And we went into their swimming pool there. That was wonderful. Beautifully tiled swimming pool. Really was nice. I'm not sure whether Singapore came before Mount Lavina and then what was Ceylon. I'm not sure the position.
I think Ceylon first, but I'm not sure either.
It was Ceylon, Singapore, or Singapore, Ceylon, whichever.
And what did you think of Ceylon? You got ashore there, mate?
Yeah, we went swimming on the. We went surfing there.
Was it Colombo you went to?
Colombo, yeah, Port Colombo, and Mount Lavina was the place where we went swimming, and some little old local there said he'd look after our uniforms while we went in the swimming pool. What we didn't realise, we didn't realise that while we were in the sea, he was going underneath the tent at the back, nicking all of our gear. But one of the lads saw him, so we managed to chase him and catch him and get all of our gear back, you know, so we didn't lose any. But then after that, we moved on to Hong Kong.
Did you get ashore there?
No. No, we didn't get in Hong Kong.
So where were you finishing up at after Hong Kong?
Busan.
So you went straight to Busan?
As we left Hong Kong, it was announced that the first 90-day ceasefire was put into progress, which was about July the 31st or August the 1st, something like that.
So you got there round about the end of July, say, really.
Yeah.
And what were your first impressions when you landed at Busan?
Well, we were just came off the ship. The only thing made us smile was we were greeted by an American brass band marching up and down the quay. The similar things you see in films, you know, remarkably similar.
And they actually did that to you as well. They're still doing it.
Yeah, they're still doing bang, running up and down the, marching a quick step up and down outside. And the port commander, who was an American, which struck us as funny, had a chrome helmet, not like ours, chrome, and he wore a red scarf, bright red scarf, and smoked a big thick cigar, and he was in charge of putting everybody ashore. Fascinating, you know, fascinating the way they carry on, and the way when we saw them salute as well, you know, very casual saluting. But we were ushered into a huge which I suppose was where the ships unloaded food and stuff in Korea in past times. And we just drew a six-legged camp bed, straw pillow and a blanket. And we had to go and into this big building and go out wherever you're told to line up. We lined up all these beds, dumped all our kit on them, and that was home then for the time being.
How long was that for?
We were there about 4 days, I think, altogether. Then you were designated different duties.
Did you know what the situation was in Korea, where the war was up to, or the ceasefire, the rest of it?
Well, yeah, as far as we knew, they just had a break and we would be ready to go, which the battalion did move off. But they took me away from the battalion. And I was attached to something else.
Now, tell me, did that happen straight away at Busan?
Almost, yeah, at Busan.
So why did they take you? What was happening?
I don't know.
You were with D Company, weren't you?
I was with D Company, and I suppose really what it was, being an NCO training instructor, and then not really in the battalion, and then the battalion had its strength, we were sort of a bit out on the limb. So they attached me to a section called the Advanced Liaison Detachment.
Now, what was that?
It was Advanced Liaison Detachment, number one Independent Field Records. That was the full title.
And was that part of the of your regiment, or was
that
this
was part of the United Nations ground forces, the whole lot.
And what was the, what did this consist of?
Well, I was in what it was, the field records was a place where all the records of all the British regiments who were serving in Korea were held, all of the lot, which controlled where they went, what they did, when they were made up, when they were charged for breaking various rules, whether they were recommended for something. All the records were number one independent field records.
And just the British?
For all the British Army, yeah. And we were really guards in charge of the safety of that complete unit, headquarters unit.
And where was it at? It was actually in Pusan, was it?
Yeah, that's where it started off. And then I went from there by a small ship called the Isang, because they had Isang and Wusang, which travelled to and from Japan to Pusan, Pusan to Kyuri, Kyuri to Pusan.
Now, hang on. So what did you do when you first joined them? You just acted as a guard. Tell us a bit about the guard role.
Guards on duty. Well, you just did what the normal guard duties were. You have 4 hours, 4 hours on, 4 hours off. And you changed duties, and you were sometimes at one part of the section, another time you'd be somewhere else. And you were just around this security.
So you weren't having anything to do with the records, you were just guarding them?
No, we were just guarding.
Now, how long were you there before you were sent on this boat?
Probably about a week or 10 days at most.
And where was the regiment? The
regiment had moved up then to...
So did you stay with the Advanced Liaison Detachment?
Yeah, all the way through my time in Korea and Japan.
So, and they were at Pusan originally?
Yeah.
Now, so what happened next then? You say you went on a boat.
Yeah,
which
we
one was it again?
The
Sorry, I'm...
Isang.
Do you know how you spell it?
It was E-S-A-N-G. And the Wosang, which was W-O-S-A-N-G, Wosang. No. There were two sort of troop ferrying boats that used to go from Pusan to Kyuri, Kyuri to Pusan, backwards and forwards all the time.
Now, why did you go on it?
I was going back to went back to Kyuri, Japan. Because they wanted water polo swimmers for the what would it have been for the HQ Japanese base regiment. That was where the
now how had you been selected that for that?
We volunteered, really. They asked if anyone had done any water polo, and I said yeah, I was a water polo swimmer. I was a racing swimmer early on in life. And I played a few games of water polo. So they said, right, you've got to pack your kit, report to the guard room whenever and whenever. And
when would this be? August or?
This was in, be August, because I was over there on my 19th birthday in August.